Part 2, The Subsidy of History. Accordingly, the single biggest subsidy to modern corporate capitalism is the subsidy of history, by which capital was originally accumulated in a few hands, and labor was deprived of access to the means of production and forced to sell itself on the buyer's terms. The current system of concentrated capital ownership and large-scale corporate organization is the direct beneficiary of that original structure of power and property ownership, which has perpetuated itself over the centuries. For capitalism as we know it to come about, it was essential first of all for labor to be separated from property. Marxians and other radical economists commonly refer to the process as primitive accumulation. What the capitalist system demanded was a degraded and almost servile condition of the mass of the people, the transformation of them into mercenaries, and of their means of labor into capital. That meant expropriating the land to which the peasantry has the same feudal rights as the lord himself. To grasp the enormity of the process, we must understand that the nobility's rights in land under the manorial economy were entirely a feudal legal fiction, deriving from conquest. The peasants who cultivated the land of England in 1650 were descendants of those who had occupied it since time immemorial. By any standard of morality, it was their property, in every sense of the word. The armies of William the Conqueror, by no right other than force, had compelled these peasant proprietors to pay rent on their own land. J.L. and Barbara Hammond treated the 16th-century village and open-field system as a survival of the free peasant society of Anglo-Saxon times, with landlordism superimposed on it. The gentry saw surviving peasant rights as a hindrance to progress and efficient farming. A revolution in their own power was a way of breaking peasant resistance. Hence, the agricultural community was taken to pieces and reconstructed in the manner in which a dictator reconstructs a free government. When the Tudors gave expropriated monastic lands to the nobility, the latter drove out, en masse, the hereditary subtenants and threw their holdings into one. This stolen land, about a fifth of the arable land of England, was the first large-scale expropriation of the peasantry. Another major theft of peasant land was the reform of land law by the 17th-century Restoration Parliament. The aristocracy abolished feudal tenures and converted their own estate in land, until then only a feudal title, into rights of modern private property. In the process, they abolished the tenure rights of copyholders. Copyholders were de jure tenants under feudal law, but once they paid a negligible quit-rent fixed by custom, the land was theirs to sell or bequeath. In substance, copyhold tenure was a manorial equivalent of freehold, but since it derived from custom, it was enforceable only in the manor courts. Under the reform, tenants in copyhold became tenants at will, who could be evicted or charged whatever rent their lord saw fit. Another form of expropriation, which began in late medieval times and increased dramatically in the 18th century, was the enclosure of commons, in which, again, the peasants communally had as absolute a right of property as any defended by today's, quote, property rights advocates. Not counting enclosures before 1700, the Hammonds estimated total enclosures in the 18th and 19th centuries at a sixth or a fifth of the arable land in England. E.J. Hobsbawm and George Rood estimated enclosures between 1750 and 1850 alone as transforming something like one quarter of the cultivated acreage from open field, common land, meadow or waste, into private fields. The ruling classes saw the peasants' right in commons as a source of economic independence from capitalist and landlord, and thus a threat to be destroyed. Enclosure eliminated a dangerous center of indiscipline, and compelled workers to sell their labor on the master's terms. Arthur Young, a Lincolnshire gentleman, described the commons as, quote, a breeding ground for barbarians, nursing up a mischievous race of people. Everyone but an idiot knows, he wrote, that the lower classes must be kept poor, or they will never be industrious. The Commercial and Agricultural Magazine warned in 1800 that leaving the laborer possessed of more land than his family can cultivate in the evenings meant that the farmer can no longer depend on him for constant work. Sir Richard Price commented on the conversion of self-sufficient proprietors into a body of men who earn their subsistence by working for others. There would, perhaps, be more labor, because there will be more compulsion to it, Marx wrote. Marx cited parliamentary acts of enclosure as evidence that the commons, far from being the private property of the great landlords who have taken the place of the feudal lords, actually required a parliamentary coup d'état for its transformation into private property. The process of primitive accumulation, in all of its brutality, was summed up by the same author. These new freedmen, i.e., former serfs, became sellers of themselves only after they had been robbed of all their own means of production, and of all the guarantees of existence afforded by the old feudal arrangements. And the history of this, their expropriation, is written in the annals of mankind in letters of blood and fire. Even then, the working class was not sufficiently powerless. The state had to regulate the movement of labor, serve as a labor exchange on behalf of capitalists, and maintain order. The system of parish regulation of the movement of people, under the poor laws and vagrancy laws, resembled the internal passport system of South Africa or the Reconstruction-era black codes. It had the same effect on the English agricultural laborer, Marx wrote, as the edict of the Tartar Boris Godunov on the Russian peasantry. Adam Smith ventured that there was scarce a poor man in England of 40 years of age who has not in some part of his life felt himself most cruelly oppressed by this ill-contrived law of settlements. The state maintained work discipline by keeping laborers from voting with their feet. It was hard to persuade parish authorities to grant a man a certificate entitling him to move to another parish to seek work. Workers were forced to stay put and bargain for work in a buyer's market. At first glance, this would seem to be inconvenient for parishes with a labor shortage. Factories were built at sources of water power, generally removed from centers of population. Thousands of workers were needed to be imported from far away. But the state saved the day by setting itself up as a middleman in providing labor-poor parishes with cheap surplus labor from elsewhere, depriving workers of the ability to bargain for better terms. A considerable trade arose in child laborers, who were in no position to bargain in any case. Relief was seldom bestowed without the parish claiming the exclusive right of disposing, at their pleasure, of all the children of the person receiving relief, in the words of the Committee on Parish Apprentices in 1815. Even when poor law commissioners encouraged migration to labor-poor parishes, they discouraged adult men, and preference was given to widows with large families of children or handicraftsmen with large families. In addition, the availability of cheap labor from the poor law commissioners was deliberately used to drive down wages. Farmers would discharge their own day laborers and instead apply to the overseer for help. Although the combination laws theoretically applied to masters as well as workmen, in practice they were not enforced against the latter. A journeyman cotton spinner, a pamphleteer quoted by E.P. Thompson, described an abominable combination existing amongst the masters, in which workers who had left their masters because of disagreement over wages were effectively blacklisted. The combination laws required suspects to answer interrogations on oath, empowered magistrates to give summary judgment, and allowed summary forfeiture of funds accumulated to aid the families of strikers. And the laws setting maximum rates of pay amounted to a state-enforced system of combination for the masters. As Adam Smith put it, whenever the legislature attempts to regulate the differences between the masters and their workmen, its counselors are always the masters. The working class lifestyle under the factory system, with its new forms of social control, was a radical break with the past. It involved drastic loss of control over their own work. The 17th century work calendar was still heavily influenced by medieval custom. Although there were long days in spurts between planting and harvest, intermittent periods of light work and the proliferation of saints' days combined to reduce average work time well below our own. And the pace of work was generally determined by the sun or the biological rhythms of the laborer, who got up after a decent night's sleep and sat down to rest when he felt like it. The cottager, who had access to common land, even when he wanted extra income from wage labor, could take work on a casual basis and then return to working for himself. This was an unacceptable degree of independence from a capitalist standpoint. In the modern world, most people have to adapt themselves to some kind of discipline and to observe other people's timetables, or work under other people's orders. But we have to remember that the population that was flung into the brutal rhythm of the factory had earned its living in relative freedom, and that the discipline of the early factory was particularly savage. No economist of the day, in estimating the gains or losses of factory employment, ever allowed for the strain and violence that a man suffered in his feelings when he passed from a life in which he could smoke or eat or dig or sleep as he pleased, to one in which somebody turned the key on him, and for 14 hours he had not even the right to whistle. It was like entering the airless and laughterless life of a prison. The factory system could not have been imposed on workers without first depriving them of alternatives, and forcibly denying access to any source of economic independence. No unbroken human being, with a sense of freedom or dignity, would have submitted to factory discipline. Stephen Marglin compared the 19th century textile factory, staffed by pauper children bought at the workhouse slave market, to Roman brick and pottery factories which were manned by slaves. In Rome, factory production was exceptional in manufacturers dominated by freemen. The factory system, throughout history, has been possible only with a workforce deprived of any viable alternative. The surviving facts strongly suggest that whether work was organized along factory lines was in Roman times determined not by technological considerations, but by the relative power of the two producing classes. Freedmen and citizens had sufficient power to maintain a guild organization. Slaves had no power, and ended up in factories. The problem with the old putting-out system, in which cottage workers produced textiles on a contractual basis, was that it only eliminated worker control of the product. The factory system, by eliminating worker control of the production process, had the advantage of discipline and supervision, with workers organized under an overseer. The origin and success of the factory lay not in technological superiority, but in the substitution of the capitalists for the workers' control of the work process and the quantity of output, in the change in the workman's choice from one of how much to work and produce based on his preferences for leisure and goods, to one of whether or not to work at all, which of course is hardly much of a choice. Marglin took Adam Smith's classic example of the division of labor in pin making and stood it on its head. The increased efficiency resulted not from the division of labor as such, but from dividing and sequencing the process into separate tasks in order to reduce setup time. This could have been accomplished by a single cottage workman separating the various tasks and then performing them sequentially, i.e., drawing out the wire for an entire run of production, then straightening it, then cutting it, etc. Without specialization, the capitalist had no essential role to play in the production process. If each producer could himself integrate the component tasks of pin manufacture into a marketable product, he would soon discover that he had no need to deal with the market for pins through the intermediation of the putter-outer. He could sell directly and appropriate to himself the profit that the capitalist derived from mediating between the producer and the market. This principle is at the center of the history of industrial technology for the last 200 years. Even given the necessity of factories for some forms of large-scale, capital-intensive manufacturing, there is usually a choice between alternate productive technologies within the factory. Industry has consistently chosen technologies which de-skill workers and shift decision-making upward into the managerial hierarchy. As long ago as 1835, Dr. Andrew Ure, the ideological grandfather of Taylorism and Fordism, argued that the more skilled the workman, the more self-willed and the less fit a component of a mechanical system he became. The solution was to eliminate processes which required peculiar dexterity and steadiness of hand from the cunning workman, and replace them by a mechanism so self-regulating that a child may superintend it. And the principle has been followed throughout the 20th century. William Lazonik, David Montgomery, David Noble, and Catherine Stone have produced an excellent body of work on this theme. Even though corporate experiments in worker self-management increase morale and productivity, and reduce injuries and absenteeism, beyond the hopes of management, they are usually abandoned out of fear of loss of control. Christopher Lash, in his foreword to Noble's America by Design, characterized the process of de-skilling in this way. The capitalist, having expropriated the worker's property, gradually expropriated his technical knowledge as well, asserting his own mastery over production. The expropriation of the worker's technical knowledge had, as a logical consequence, the growth of modern management, in which technical knowledge came to be concentrated. As the scientific management movement split up production into its component procedures, reducing the worker to an appendage of the machine, a great expansion of technical and supervisory personnel took place in order to oversee the productive process as a whole. The expropriation of the peasantry and imposition of the factory labor system was not accomplished without resistance. The workers knew exactly what was being done to them and what they had lost. During the 1790s, when rhetoric from the Jacobins and Tom Paine were widespread among the radicalized working class, the rulers of the, quote, cradle of liberty lived in terror that the country would be swept by revolution. The system of police state control over the population resembled an alien occupation regime. The Hammonds referred to correspondence between North Country magistrates and the Home Office, in which the law was frankly treated, quote, as an instrument not of justice, but of repression, and the working classes appeared conspicuously as a helot population. In the light of the Home Office papers, none of the personal rights attaching to Englishmen possessed any reality for the working classes. The magistrates and their clerks recognized no limit to their powers over the freedom and the movements of working men. The vagrancy laws seemed to supersede the entire charter of an Englishman's liberties. They were used to put into prison any man or woman of the working class who seemed to the magistrate an inconvenient or disturbing character. They offered the easiest and most expeditious way of proceeding against anyone who tried to collect money for the families of locked-out workmen, or to disseminate literature that the magistrates thought undesirable. Peel's bobbies, professional law enforcement, replaced the posse comitatus system because the latter was inadequate to control a population of increasingly disaffected workmen. In the time of the Luddite and other disturbances, Crown officials warned that to apply the Watch and Ward Act would be to put arms into the hands of the most powerfully disaffected. At the outset of the wars with France, Pitt ended the practice of quartering the army in alehouses mixed with the general population. Instead, the manufacturing districts were covered with barracks as, quote, purely a matter of police. The manufacturing areas came to resemble a country under military occupation. Pitt's police state was supplemented by quasi-private vigilantism in the time-honored tradition of black shirts and death squads ever since. For example, the Association for the Protection of Property Against Republicans and Levelers, an anti-Jacobin association of gentry and mill owners, conducted house-to-house searches and organized Guy Fawkes-style effigy burnings against Paine. Church and King mobs terrorized suspected radicals. Thompson characterized this system of control as political and social apartheid, and argued that the revolution which did not happen in England was fully as devastating as the one that did happen in France. Finally, the state aided the growth of manufacturers through mercantilism. Modern exponents of the, quote, free market generally treat mercantilism as a misguided attempt to promote some unified national interest, adopted out of sincere ignorance of economic principles. In fact, the architects of mercantilism knew exactly what they were doing. Mercantilism was extremely efficient for its real purpose, making wealthy manufacturing interests rich at the expense of everyone else. Adam Smith consistently attacked mercantilism, not as a product of economic error, but as a quite intelligent attempt by powerful interests to enrich themselves through the coercive power of the state. British manufacturing was created by state intervention to shut out foreign goods, give British shipping a monopoly of foreign commerce, and stamp out foreign competition by force. As an example of the latter, British authorities in India destroyed the Bengalese textile industry, makers of the highest quality fabric in the world. although they had not adopted steam-driven methods of production, there is a real possibility that they would have done so, had India remained politically and economically independent. The once prosperous territory of Bengal today is occupied by Bangladesh and the Calcutta area. The American, German, and Japanese industrial systems were created by the same mercantilist policies, with massive tariffs on industrial goods. Free trade, quote-unquote, was adopted by safely established industrial powers, who used laissez-faire as an ideological weapon to prevent potential rivals from following the same path of industrialization. Capitalism has never been established by means of the free market, or even by the primary action of the bourgeoisie. It has always been established by a revolution from above, imposed by a pre-capitalist ruling class. In England, it was the landed aristocracy. In France, Napoleon II's bureaucracy. In Germany, the Junkers. In Japan, the Meiji. In America, the closest approach to a natural bourgeois evolution, industrialization was carried out by a mercantilist aristocracy of federalist shipping magnates and landlords. Romantic medievalists like Chesterton and Belloc described the process in the High Middle Ages by which serfdom had gradually withered away and the peasants had transformed themselves into de facto freeholders who paid a nominal quitrent. The feudal class system was disintegrating and being replaced by a much more libertarian and less exploitive one. Immanuel Wallerstein argued that the likely outcome would have been a system of relatively equal small-scale producers, further flattening out the aristocracies and decentralizing the political structures. By 1650, the trend had been reversed, and there was a reasonably high level of continuity between the families that had been high strata in 1450 and in 1650. Capitalism, far from being the overthrow of a backward aristocracy by a progressive bourgeoisie, was brought into existence by a landed aristocracy which transformed itself into a bourgeoisie because the old system was disintegrating. This is echoed in part by Arno Meyer, who argued for continuity between the landed aristocracy and the capitalist ruling class. The process by which the high medieval civilization of peasant proprietors, crafts guilds, and free cities was overthrown was vividly described by Kropotkin. Before the invention of gunpowder, the free cities repelled royal armies more often than not, and won their independence from feudal dues. And these cities often made common cause with peasants in their struggles to control the land. The absolutist state and the capitalist revolution it imposed became possible only when artillery could reduce fortified cities with a high degree of efficiency, and the king could make war on his own people. And in the aftermath of this conquest, the Europe of William Morris was left devastated, depopulated, and miserable. Peter Tosh had a song called 400 Years. Although the white working class has suffered nothing like the brutality of black slavery, there has nevertheless been a 400 years of oppression for all of us under the system of state capitalism established in the 17th century. Ever since the birth of the first states 6,000 years ago, political coercion has allowed one ruling class or another to live off other people's labor. But since the 17th century, the system of power has become increasingly conscious, unified, and global in scale. The current system of transnational state capitalism, without rival since the collapse of the Soviet bureaucratic class system, is a direct outgrowth of the seizure of power 400 years ago. Orwell had it backwards. The past is a boot smashing a human face. Whether the future is more of the same depends on what we do now.